Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Asking for Myself. Mia here, super excited for this episode and for you guys to be here. I know it's been a minute since I published an episode. I don't even want to look at the date of the last episode because I can't believe it. I literally love doing this podcast so much. It's one of my favorite things that I'm working on, but I feel like somehow it always gets deprioritized. And then I try to remember that I'm trying to do a lot of things and I have to figure out how to balance it all. And maybe that's where boundaries come in, but we're going to get into that later. Well, actually, we're going to get into it the entire episode because that's the theme of the episode. So anyway, I am joined today by Clara, who is a codependency recovery coach and a people-pleasing expert, as well as Lacey Simmons, a licensed therapist with an emphasis on boundaries. And I really wanted to do this episode because I feel like everybody talks about boundaries and it's not always clear, like, what are boundaries? What does it look like to set a boundary? I think people also misuse the term, or maybe they think boundaries is about like telling someone else what to do rather than just like the boundaries that they're putting on themselves and like their actions and behaviors, and where, like, if I, you know, say, you know, I won't put myself in this environment, or I will not accept certain treatment and set a boundary for myself. Clearly, I am not the expert, and that's why I have my guests on today's episode, because I cannot tell you, I desperately need help with boundaries and people pleasing. And I thought this episode was amazing because honestly, it really kind of flipped people pleasing on its head for me. I think it's something I always identified as a people pleaser, and it's easy to kind of hold resentment against other people for, you know, why am I always doing so much for other people and why is it not reciprocal? But then it's like, wait a minute, why am I doing that? And, you know, where can I change my behaviors and identify things within myself instead of placing blame on other people? And it goes with those boundaries. Okay, so anyway, let's get into the episode. And what do I say? We know what it is. Without further ado, let's talk taboo. Okay, hello and welcome back to another episode. I'm super, super excited for today's topic, which is boundaries and people pleasing, something that I've definitely struggled with and I know so many people struggle with. So just to kick us off, would each of you mind introducing yourself and a little bit about your work?
Hi, everyone. My name is Lacey Simmons. I go by The Boundary Therapist on Instagram. I am a licensed therapist in the state of California, and among many things that I'm passionate about, it's boundary work and teaching folks why it's important and how we can set them.
My name's Clara. I go as Fitting Right In on Instagram. I'm a codependency recovery coach, and I consider myself a people-pleasing expert and a recovering people-pleaser myself. And I'm really excited that we get to talk about boundaries today, because boundaries are one of the most empowering things that I've personally learned. So I know how important this information is to get out there for other people. And yeah, I'm really looking forward for this.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Also, I'm going to have to ask you about codependency and what that actually is and what that looks like in a bit, because I'm curious about what the term like actually means. I know we use a lot of terms that many of us don't know the actual meaning of, but we, you know, throw them around anyway. So I know that a lot of people come into the mental health space and into this type of work due to their own personal experiences and background. So can you each just share, like, how did you get into this? Why did you decide to focus on what you're focusing on? And what is your own personal story with people pleasing and setting boundaries?
For me, my personal journey with people pleasing kind of started, you know, I think it started in childhood. I don't really remember never not people pleasing. So for me, when I though discovered that I was a people pleaser and how much pain that brought into my life was when I was in my PhD program 1 year in, and I felt completely miserable. And I've worked towards getting this PhD for, at that point, 7 years. Though kind of like in the back of my head, always knowing that it wasn't really what I wanted to do. But I felt like I always had this lack of knowing what I wanted to do. And I always felt like very imprisoned by what other people think of me, what they say of me, what they expect of me, what they want of me, and not necessarily having people in my life that pushed me to do any of those things, but me just thinking what they were thinking in a way. So for me, I really had to pause during the pandemic for the very first time, which I think a lot of people have experienced, right? Because I used to just bury myself in work and bury my feelings of being miserable in work. And then the pandemic caused me to hit pause and then realize, you know, like, since I couldn't work at home because I didn't have a lab set up, I just started doing things that I enjoy. And for the first time, I realized, wait, there's nothing wrong with me. Because up until that point, I always wondered, is there something wrong with me that I can't be happy, that I feel so miserable? And I really figured out that there is nothing wrong with me. And so I really set out on this journey after dropping out of my PhD to kind of investigate, why is it I can't make decisions? Why is it I don't know what I want to do? And realized that people pleasing caused a lot of pain in my life and I have had a lot of problems with it. So that's my story of how I discovered I was a people pleaser. And from there, I just studied a lot about it and really put in the work to try to figure out how to get rid of it.
Thanks for sharing that. My experience is definitely personal. That's really mixed in with professional. I feel like I didn't have a great example of how to set boundaries. I didn't really even know what boundaries were until adulthood, or what healthy boundaries were, I guess I should say. So it was really a personal journey also that I went on. And in my therapeutic work with people, I came to really realize that it is just an underlying challenge that most people face. And it really is the root cause to a lot of specific depression and anxiety that people experience. And so really being able to kind of get to the root cause of what's actually happening and the dynamics of relationships. And then I was diagnosed with a chronic illness in my late 20s. And that sort of also compacted my journey of realizing that I was forced to start setting boundaries in a way that I really hadn't practiced. And so that definitely shaped my experience and passion toward helping others to be able to get to the place where they're living with healthy boundary setting and really retention in their life.
Yeah, 100%. Thank you both for sharing your stories. I can definitely resonate with a lot of it. And I think I was actually curious, is indecisiveness a trait of people pleasers? Like, is that something that tends to go along with people pleasing? Because I know that I can be, I guess it makes sense where you're constantly thinking about what is going to benefit somebody else or making decisions that would keep the peace, you know, so to speak. And then not really knowing what you want. But yeah, is indecisiveness part of a people-pleasing nature?
Yeah, I would definitely think so. Let me put it this way. Not everyone who's indecisive is necessarily a people-pleaser, but I would certainly say that most of the people who struggle with people-pleasing are indecisive. And it's just because when you people-please, you put on this facade, right? You become a different person, you become a chameleon, and that causes you to distance yourself from your feelings, from your opinions. And when that happens for a very long time, we cannot access our feelings, our needs anymore. And then it gets very difficult to make decisions because what do you base them on?
Right. Exactly. You don't even know what you want at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
So where does this nature to people please come from? And are certain people more prone to people pleasing? Obviously, I would imagine that most of us socialized as women are people pleasers. But, you know, is it about a specific childhood upbringing? Is it, you know, what kind of tends to go along with becoming a people pleaser?
I'm very curious what Lacey would have to say about this as like a therapist in the field. So if you don't mind, I'd be super curious to hear what you'd say.
Yeah, for sure. Where does people pleasing come from? Early childhood, right? So it really, if you think about like 2-year-olds, oftentimes that's when people start to assert like their boundaries and saying no. And when we don't have secure attachments with our caregivers, oftentimes what happens is we interpret safety based on what other people are telling us, right? So we're trying to assert a boundary. We're trying to say, this is what I want and need. And if our caregiver isn't providing that secure attachment for us, we are learning that we have to appease other people in order to create health and safety in our life. And so that really evolves and shows up in adulthood as continued behaviors of people pleasing. That's one of the examples of why that can sort of start from a therapeutic lens.
I love that. And I totally agree that for a majority of people, it starts in childhood. And everything is a spectrum, right? So like you could also develop people-pleasing tendencies in a relationship later, right? There's no black or white. There's a lot of things in between. But I do find that for most people, especially also my clients, it starts in childhood. It starts with your parents maybe not respecting your boundaries, or when you say no, they get really upset. Mm-hmm. And then you feel like it's not safe to say no. So very similar to what you were saying, right? Like depending on how our parents react when we set boundaries, assert ourselves or express our feelings, mm-hmm. Depending if they're there for us or not, really creates this idea that we have to manage our parents in order for them to take care of us and for it to be a safe environment for us as kids, knowing that as children, we can't escape the reality. So we create often this idea that like, if I manage mom and dad well enough, if I make them happy, then they can be there for me in a way that I need them to. Mm-hmm. Right. And then we carry that on in adulthood because that's what we've learned. We've kind of like, instead of sharing our feelings and needs openly and bringing them to the table, we've learned not to do that. And we've replaced our first nature of doing that with people pleasing. And then in adulthood, usually it starts creating real problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, go on, Lacey.
Just you sparked my thought too. Like I appreciate you bringing in the concept of a spectrum, because I think that's really important just when you're thinking about, behavior in general and why people, there's many reasons why it happens. And another one of those main reasons can be that it's a trauma response, right? So you may have heard the term fawning. That's sort of an aspect of a trauma response that I think has gotten a lot of light in the past 5 to 10 years. It used to only be, freeze, fight or flight, but we also are fawning, which means that oftentimes in a trauma response, we are wanting to people please our way out of situations. And so that can also be a very real scenario for folks if they have experienced significant trauma for whatever that looks like in their, mm-hmm. other parts of their life. So it's a really important thing to consider as well.
Yeah, I definitely think it makes so much sense, because as a kid, you just want to feel loved. You want to feel safe. And so if there's a chaotic situation, or if there's some type of, your parents are upset, like you both were talking about, you just want to make everything okay. And you think that the best way to do this is to compromise your own needs, to compromise your own feelings. Like if you're crying and it's therefore causing stress, okay, maybe I shouldn't cry anymore. Maybe I just need to do whatever it is that's going to make my parents happy or my caregivers happy. So I think that's super interesting. And then of course, that carries into adulthood, because you don't learn that your needs and your feelings even matter. So you're not even going to be trying to assert them because you don't know how. And you also never were taught that it would even matter if you did. Or maybe you were actually taught literally that it didn't matter if you tried to express your needs and your feelings. So Lacey, I'm really glad you mentioned attachment style specifically, and that you both mentioned childhood, because we recently did an episode about attachment styles and early childhood development and kind of all of that leading into your adult relationship patterns. And I'm really curious, because Lacey, I saw this post that you did about avoidant specifically and saying yes more, and how I think with avoidant attachment, the caregiver can, violate or ignore your boundaries. So maybe you're taught your boundaries don't matter. And then maybe you extra assert, that wall and that layer of defense as you get older. And then I would imagine maybe the opposite with anxious attachment where you're ignoring your needs and your boundaries because you want to please your partner. So I guess, can you maybe just briefly talk about how it impacts the different attachment styles and kind of, and I guess most importantly, like how to start unlearning that and like what maybe your relationship with boundaries and people pleasing, how it might be a little different in how you would approach it based on your attachment style?
Yeah, for sure. I think that's super key because when we oftentimes hear people talk about boundaries, everyone thinks of just like, no. And the reality is like boundary setting is a spectrum, right? And so it ranges from porous boundaries, which are typically boundaries that people pleasers or folks with anxious attachment lean toward, where they have a really difficult time setting and holding boundaries. People kind of walk all over them. And then the spectrum reaches the other side where we have really rigid boundaries or walls. And those walls oftentimes look like boundaries that are set by avoidant attachment style folks. And the ideal is that we would get to the middle of that, right? And so if you had like a disorganized attachment style, you might be kind of all over the place and one day able to set a healthy boundary and the next you're, you know, sort of rebuttaling on that and it's a little bit confusing for yourself and everyone else involved. So a healthy attachment would be someone who is able to know their self, understand what their needs are, and really be able to set healthy boundaries that also have flexibility, right? Like what we need to say no to one day might look very different than a year or 6 months from now. And that's a really important aspect of being able to set healthy boundaries and communicate what our needs are.
Yeah, I think as I was thinking about that, the more that I've come to understand my own attachment style, I do think it is the disorganized, which is, from my understanding, you know, more challenging. And I think it makes, I mean, it's great to start to understand and to work through and to have that basis of knowledge. But it definitely, I think that sort of not knowing and that confusion and kind of the back and forth, the push and pull, like all of it is very relatable for my life and definitely I think has tied into a lot of these like people pleasing tendencies and other things. So one thing I did also want to talk about is just the concept of being a perfectionist and like wanting things to be perfect. And if that's the same as people pleasing, like do people who tend to want things to be perfect or they're really high achievers, is that more of like an intrinsic goal and value to have things be perfect? Or is it wanting things to be perfect for fear that if they're not perfect, you know, people will be mad at you or you will be seen as less than or whatever? Like, is it related, would you say?
Yeah. I would definitely say it's related. I think the idea behind perfectionism and people pleasing and where they tie together is that it's a defense mechanism. It's a defense mechanism against criticism, against not feeling enough, against really having to take risk and taking a step forward often, because perfectionism holds us back in what we're trying to achieve. Because instead of, you know, stepping forward as we progress, we hold back, try to perfect it, which is impossible, right? And even if perfection was possible, you would only get there by starting imperfectly and then improving from there on, trying to get to where it's perfect, right? So it does tie into the idea that if I do everything perfectly, I'm safe. Mm-hmm. And it comes from this place of, also, a lot of people pleasers have experienced very critical parents growing up. They're highly critical to themselves. So it's also a defense mechanism in the way that if I can criticize myself first and do everything perfectly and find all the mistakes, then no one will criticize me, right? It's defending yourself against that.
I've read that or seen that like perfect is the enemy of good or great, or like basically that you're always better off just getting something out there. A lot of people will, I myself included, will, you know, oh, I can't post this until I've really made this perfect post. And it's like, why am I spending hours it doesn't really matter, you know, and there's never the, yeah, it's like you said, sort of warding off that criticism or the fear that it's not going to be 100%. And therefore you either, a lot of people will end up doing nothing at all. Like maybe they don't apply to the job or to the program or to whatever it is that they want because they fear that rejection or they feel like, you know, they're not good enough. And then on the flip side, some people will just like delay things or, you know, I think just like prevent themselves from pursuing what they actually want to pursue. And actually what you just mentioned, Clara, was about kind of that self-worth and feeling like you're not good enough. And I want to know, with self-esteem, like what is self-esteem? Is that confidence or is self-esteem more so how you feel about what you deserve in life? Like what is self-esteem and where does self-esteem come from? Does it come from our caregivers? Is it from within? Like what is self-esteem?
It's a mix of different things. I think it's most closely related to self-worth. So if you think of self-worth for me, how I explain it to myself is that self-worth is something that doesn't necessarily change. It's a very steady idea of this is how much I'm worth, right? It's like the base layer. And then you have self-esteem, which is sitting right on top of that, which though changes depending on your mood, how you're feeling, what your thoughts are, what's happening. It's fluctuating a lot more and depends on what is really happening in the moment. So self-esteem depends on like how you're feeling about yourself today. You might feel, you know, very nervous today and feel like you're not doing a good enough job at work, but then you come home to your partner and there you feel like you're doing everything right and you're really happy or vice versa. So self-esteem changes depending on where you are, what your feelings are, what your moods are. And it ties into confidence to a degree because how you feel about yourself is like how capable you deem yourself to do something. And your thoughts can really hold you back in what you think you can achieve. And they shape your perception. So you might have a lot of opportunities that you don't see because you're talking yourself out of them. You're not paying enough attention to them because we all have our confirmation bias in our brain, right? So we're looking for confirmation to what we believe to be true. And if we think we can't do a certain thing, we're going to look for more opportunities to confirm that belief. Whereas if we were to think like, hey, I can figure things out, I won't do it perfectly, but I can, we're going to find ways to look at things at like, okay, I can do this and I can do that. And we just don't see that. And that's how it ties into confidence, I think.
Yeah. And confidence too, in a lot of ways, is socially constructed, right? Like we tell people what it means to be confident. And we can look outwardly at someone and say, oh, they exhibit so many of these confident sort of attributes, but they could have really, really poor self-esteem. So, you know, they don't necessarily go hand in hand. They can, but they also very much might not.
I love that. That's a great point of like confidence. It's more as like how you're perceived. Not necessarily your internal experience of what's really going on in the moment.
Exactly.
Do you think people who, like I know I've heard, you know, fake it till you make it or just try to exude that confidence and then because it is perception, right? So when you appear confident, a lot of times it instills confidence in others because they believe in what you're projecting. Do you think that by doing that, it can help boost your self-esteem, or is that often just a facade? I know, obviously, I'm sure it can go like in any direction, but is there something to trying to just show that confidence, even if you don't feel confident, that would trigger something in your brain to start believing, you know, I actually am this. I actually am confident. I actually do feel good about myself.
Yeah. I don't necessarily love the term fake it till you make it. It always makes me cringe a little bit because I don't love the idea of faking. But there are certain things that we can do to fake or like push our confidence. For example, like how we're standing or like posture, right? In somatics, like you see that it like, if you had a lot of trauma, some, you know, psychiatrists can see it in the way how you're sitting on the sofa, how you hold yourself. So when you walk across the street and you always have your head down, maybe just having that act of like, I'm going to keep my head up, I'm going to be still, you know, scared, will though change something within you. So I think there are certain things that you can do to boost yourself as to boost your self-esteem and to boost your confidence. But in the end, it's also just being emotionally resilient, being like, hey, I'm scared, but I'm going to do it anyways. Right? Because I feel like this idea of, oh, I will boost my confidence this way kind of makes people think when I'm confident enough, then I can do it. And that doesn't exist. That point doesn't exist. You will be scared. You will feel guilty. You will feel judged. You will feel ashamed, maybe even, right? But you're going to have to do it anyways.
And you also will fail sometimes, right? Like failure is a part of growth. It's a part of life. It's a part of learning. It's part of everything, anything yet that you want to accomplish, you're going to have. And failure doesn't have to be a huge failure. Failure can exist in many different ways and it looks different for everyone. So how do you recommend in terms of that emotional resilience and in terms of like just maintaining that sense of self-worth and confidence and self-esteem? When people do start to experience failure, maybe they put themselves out there. They're like, you know what? I'm going to try for it. I don't need to be perfect. I'm going to do this anyway. I'm going to apply. I'm going to try. I'm going to reach out to this person, whatever it is. And then it doesn't go well, or it doesn't, yeah. They don't have the results that they intended to have. Like, how can you build that sense of resilience and still not take it personally when you do experience rejection or failure?
I think like, self-compassion from my perspective is super important to practice, and this is a really difficult thing for folks who have low self-esteem oftentimes, because they're not always able to identify that they are doing great in certain areas. But self-compassion really teaches us that suffering is a part of life, and it's okay for us to feel disappointed and let down and sort of crummy about what happened. And that experience doesn't paint the full picture of who we are, right? So really finding ways through guided meditation and really just allowing yourself to sit in the tolerance of, that's really hard for me and I'm upset with the way that that happened. Also, I'm still doing okay and proud of myself that I tried.
I also think that, Nick, how do you define failure, right? If you want to have a new job, start a new career, you apply to the first place, you might not get it. That's okay. That's not a failure. That's just a bump in the road. So if you're willing to keep going and to keep pushing, then what does failure even really mean, right? Sometimes you just have to keep going and then you won't fail.
Yeah, the fact that you're just continuing on is the success, right? It's just because that's life. You're going to experience hardship and failure and whatever, again, what that looks like to you. And I think self-compassion is super, super important, Lacey, like you were saying, because we often are just so critical of ourselves and hard on ourselves and have these super high expectations, unrealistic expectations. And that can start in childhood from, you know, our caregivers and those around us who want the best for us, or who want whatever their perceived best is for us, and pushing those, you know, values or dreams or hopes onto us. And I think it can be hard to not internalize. And also society has all these markers of what it looks like to be successful, whether that's like career success or being in a relationship, or, you know, all these things that are determined, you know, a successful, thriving person. And we don't want to be the not, like, you know, the person who's like, doesn't have it together. They don't know what they're doing, or we think people even care, but they probably are more consumed with their feelings of themselves. I often have to remind myself of that we're all really thinking about ourselves far more than we're thinking about what anybody else is doing.
Setting boundaries is all about self-care and self-preservation. And a brand that embodies both of those things is Semaine. Semaine Health is a wellness brand backed by science. They create clinically trialed supplements to support you and your hormones from puberty through menopause. I take their daily, which is their daily vitamin/supplement pill for hormonal balance, and their PMS support pill leading up to and at the start of my period for major cramp relief. Semaine was founded by twin sisters with endometriosis and one of their husbands, a biomedical engineer. They are super transparent and run third-party clinical trials for their supplements, which is something I think is absolutely incredible and super, super important in the wellness space, and not enough companies do it. The results and the reviews speak for themselves, so I highly recommend you check them out. Remember, everyone's body is different and responds to everything differently. So take what I'm saying with a grain of salt, check them out for yourself, read the reviews, look at the clinical trials, and head to SemaineHealth.com and use code TABU, that's T-A-B-U, for 20% off your purchase. Let me know what you think.
I think like all of this ties in obviously to what we're talking about. And as we move into talking specifically about like boundaries and setting boundaries, I want to talk about why we think it's mean or selfish to say no. And then I want to talk about like, yeah, what are boundaries? And I know it's not just saying no, but specifically with saying no to people, or if, you know, your friend asks you to help them move, or if, or whatever, like your sibling is like, hey, can you do this thing for me? Whatever it is, people are asking us things. And sometimes we do have the capacity to do it, but maybe we don't want to do it. Or maybe we don't have the capacity, but we feel bad and we feel guilty. So why do we think it's mean or wrong to say no to someone? Especially also really quickly, I want to add, even in the context of like being at a bar or being out and someone asks for your number and you feel like mean if you don't give it to them, right? Like there's other scenarios where it comes up and you feel bad about something, but it's like, why? Like, why is it, why? It's not mean.
I think there are multiple factors, right? Depending on, as we touched on earlier, if in childhood your boundaries weren't respected or your parents got really upset with you when you said no, then you learn that saying no is a bad thing. It's not an empowering thing. It's a bad thing. It's something you're not supposed to do. And then another big factor I found is that when we say no to someone, we disappoint them sometimes. And as people who are empathetic and care for others, which is most likely someone who struggles with people pleasing, right? We feel a little bit of their disappointment. And instead of, you know, detaching from that and saying they're disappointed, that's okay, we take that on as something, and then we turn it in ourselves into something. Oh my God, I made them feel this way. Oh my God, I'm a horrible person for saying no, when really we just feel a little bit of their disappointment and we take it on as our own instead of creating a little bit of space to understand that it's not our feeling, it's the other person's.
Absolutely. Similar thing that I was going to say, right? Like we have all experienced rejection in life oftentimes, and it's super painful. And so we have a lot of anticipatory expectations of what the other person will be responding to when we say no. And that's really about us. It's usually about, man, I hate it when people say no to me, or I have been hurt by this in the past. So that is going to happen when I do this. And we paint this whole picture and create this story that's just not reality. And we attach it to that experience and oftentimes just avoid that altogether because we have decided that this is the way that the story is going to play out.
I love that. And I love that you say story, because we're really subscribed to the stories we tell ourselves about what's happening. I feel we've all had a friend text us a question if we can help out with something. We say no, and then we paint the picture in our head, the story, this narrative. Oh my God, they're so mad, when in reality they just put their phone away and they were moved on with their day completely normally. So we're spinning on these narratives and stories that we subscribe to. Yeah.
And in some cases, I know I'm always like, we're always, I know I am painting this whole, you know, yeah, narrative of, oh, well, I know that this, they're going to feel this way, or they're going to whatever, or they're going to think I'm a bad friend. They're going to think I don't care. They're going to think this, whatever. And I guess, well, how would you respond to the fact that in some cases they will, you know, like, especially if you know the person, right? And you know how they will respond, maybe particularly with like a family member or a friend, you know them well enough and you know how they feel. Maybe you've seen them react to other people saying no, or, you know, you just know how they would react. What do you do in those instances where you're right? You know, you are making up a story, but that story is true. And maybe your friend will be upset with you, yeah, or think you're selfish or something.
I think loving detachment is key. It's understanding that other people have to manage their own feelings. And I find that as a recovering people pleaser, I always managed other people's feelings, in part because I had the subconscious belief that they weren't capable of dealing with their own feelings, and I was much better at it because I was so empathetic, because I could take care of them, I could anticipate their needs, I knew what they needed. So noticing that they might not be as good at it and noticing that I could be really helpful, in my head made up this idea that I had to help, that I cannot let them down, that I have to manage. And it's also recognizing that we need to give other people the opportunity to learn how to manage disappointment.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So true. And it's so much about realizing again that so much of our own stuff is coming up in those experiences, right? Like in order to recover from people pleasing, you have to come back to yourself and you have to stop abandoning yourself. And you have a choice in those moments to experience discomfort, right? By setting that limit or saying no and choosing to come back and heal your inner child, right? Like really coming home to yourself and saying, you know, in this moment, I recognize that this is difficult and there's going to be potential upset that happens. And I'm choosing me for once because my whole life I have chosen other people.
Yeah. Would you go so far as to say, I guess, well, one, I want to ask about just the concept of like people who tend to be more takers, right? Where they will take as much as they can and may not give as much. That's not necessarily reciprocal. And I find that there's often a dynamic where those types of people tend to be friends with or close with a person who is more so a people pleaser and who will give everything of themselves. Do you think that that's intentional, that people are seeking out a people pleaser, or is it just human nature to kind of take what you can get? And if someone has set the precedent that they will drop everything for you or that they will be there for you no matter what or do anything you need help with or do anything for you, that you just, you know, you take it for granted maybe, but you end up like, I guess, yeah, is that like intentional sort of taking advantage of someone, do you find often? Or is it just that a people pleaser may attract this person to their life and just keep that and not set the boundaries? So therefore, they're going to experience like an overabundance of being asked to do things, if that makes sense?
Yeah. Again, I think both can be true. I think the majority of the time, it is not something someone actively seeks. I don't think we're that conscious of what we're looking for. There are, of course, exceptions to the rule of very malicious people who do this, who prey on people who are very giving. But I also want to turn this on its head, right? People pleasers seek out people who need to be needed, who want to be needed. It's not like, you know, it's not like people go out there and try to find someone who only gives. It's like, we're also looking for someone who needs because it fulfills what we're looking for.
Yeah,
that's snaps all around for that one. Lacey, did you have anything?
No, I just like that. Yeah. When you were asking that question, that's where my brain went, right? Mm-hmm. Of like, I don't know what other people's intentions are, but I do know that people pleasers tend to want to fulfill that cycle in life where that's what they have created as safety, and so they are seeking that out, just as Clara said.
Interestingly, with that, because I think that's so true and makes a ton of sense, I know that in my experience I have found that I do love to help people. It's like I genuinely love it. I genuinely enjoy being there for people and giving. And probably, you know, don't, you know, I'm still working on like how to set my own boundaries and express my own needs and create reciprocal relationships. But at the same time, I've definitely experienced resentment or frustration over time where it does start to feel that it's not reciprocal or where it does start to feel like it's taken for granted. So given that, you know, you're seeking that, you're seeking to be someone who's helpful and who's empathetic and doing things for others, but then still experiencing like, well, why isn't anyone doing this for me? How does that dynamic work? And how, Like, if it's something you actually want to be doing, why do you start to feel frustrated that you're doing it?
Do you want to speak a little bit to codependency here? I feel like that's like
the difference,
right? Like someone who's healthy and someone who enters into codependency.
So I guess I'm a little stumped because I forgot your question.
That's okay. My question is, given that, like you said, that people pleasers may seek out people who they can give to, right? And who may need them, or that they perceive like they need me, or I want to be helpful, I want to be needed. But then on the flip side, can experience resentment or frustration because they're constantly giving and it doesn't feel like they're getting in return. So I guess if it's something that you're seeking out that you want, but then at the same time, you actually don't, if it's too much or you feel taken advantage of, like, how does that work?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's difficult to anticipate, you know, that, okay, I really want to do this. And then if it doesn't get reciprocal, you will not know that in the future, right? So you kind of have to experience it. You have to continue asking for what you need in order to also get what you want back from other people. I feel like people aren't often asking, right? They aren't often asking for what they want and what they need, or they trick themselves into thinking that it might be different, that they can save another person, right? Mm-hmm. And as you said, codependency plays into this because, I mean, at its core, it is a unhealthy relationship with the self, right? That you experienced that you need another. Sorry, I'm super stumped right now. I can't continue my train of thought.
It's okay. Do you want a second, or do you want Lacey to jump in?
Jump in, Lacey, please.
Okay, no worries. Yeah, so I think, like Clara was saying, like, it really comes back to a relationship with self, right? If I don't have a good compass of what my wants and my needs are, I am going to be over-identifying with the needs of other people, right? And when that becomes unhealthy is when we are attaching all of our experiences to our partner or a parent or someone who we are really enmeshed with. And when they feel sad, we also take on sadness. We have no ability to separate our experiences and be autonomous from the other person's navigation of emotions in life, right? And so I think people pleasers really struggle with this. And what really has to happen is you have to get to the point where you're so sick of it that you really want to change. And that happens through that resentment and that challenge of like, no, there's no reciprocity in this relationship. And I am to the point where something has to give, right? And so there's a lot of having to respond with taking accountability for the part that we play in those relationships in order for us to change. But it really has to start with learning yourself and trusting yourself and coming back home to yourself. Otherwise, you have no idea what you need and you can't make action steps forward because you're reliant on other people to tell you what you need.
Yeah, you put that perfectly.
It also makes me think of this. I don't know if either of you watch Friends or watched Friends at any point, but it makes me think of the episode where they talk about how inherently like there's no good deed, right? Or like that every good deed is selfish, because even if you donate to a cause or you do something really good, it's making you feel good. So therefore it's actually like quote unquote selfish, or you know, it's like self-interested. And I just think that's really funny and kind of interesting with what we're talking about, where totally. With the nature to people please, it's you think that you're doing it for other people, and you are, but you are also doing it for yourself. And like the whatever you're getting from it is that, you know, something you need or something you feel that you need, or and then maybe over time you find that it's not serving you. But I think a lot of people pleasers may think like, yeah, all I do is give to other people. And then it's like identifying and reflecting back that like, well, why am I doing that? And what is it doing for me? Why do I do this? Why do I feel this need to do this? So I just kind of was thinking about that. I was recently reading Nedra Tawab's book about setting boundaries. It's like set boundaries, keep the peace, I think is what it's called.
Set boundaries, find peace. Yeah.
Yes, set boundaries, find peace. And then I just got the workbook as well. And at the beginning of it, she talks about how, you know, a client will come in and talk about how they're just overwhelmed and they're feeling, you know, they've got so much on their plate and all these expectations of others. And then she identifies like, oh, you know, what you actually need is a new relationship with setting boundaries. And I'm wondering, what are the traits that you might, like Lacey, you kind of said, where you might see, okay, this isn't working for me anymore. I just can't do this anymore. Like, how do people start to identify, okay, maybe I do struggle with this, or I struggle with it to a point where I need to rethink things. I need support. I need help. What is it? What would you say to look out for in terms of knowing, hey, I need a new relationship with boundaries?
For sure. Overwhelm is a huge one. Resentment in relationships is also key. You know, I've done so much for this person and they're just like taking advantage of my time. There's a lot of that comes up and it's like, well, have you ever communicated with them or told them that, you know, you're overextending yourself? I also think like enmeshment is a big one that we see in therapy, because oftentimes we'll ask about, you know, what's your relationship like with your partner or your family? And it's like, oh, we do everything together. And, you know, I'm super over reliant on them to make decisions. Yet I'm still not feeling like I am in a healthy place, right? And so oftentimes there's just like, again, that codependency and being able to have to feel like you have to navigate life with another person or people's. And then from a mental health perspective, it's a lot of anxiety. A lot of people come in with identified anxiety. That's one of the main reasons people seek out therapy. And we often find that it's a lack of identifying and being able to know what your boundaries are and being able to set them in a healthy way. So it can really sprout up in a lot of ways, but those are some of the sort of experiences that come to mind that I see.
I think helplessness is a big one too, where you seem like you're really stuck and you don't know how to get your power back. Mm-hmm. You really have no idea how to say no, or even how to identify what to say no to in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely think that that's a huge component, and it makes me think of just to put her on blast, I know she'll listen, but like my mom was exactly who I was thinking of with just, you know, the overwhelm or feeling that sort of helplessness, like I can't say no, you know, I have to do this. I have to be there for this person. I have to do this work project. Like there is no reality of saying no. And I'm always like, what are you afraid will happen if you say no? You know, like you can say no, or you can say, maybe it's not no, it's this isn't, I can't do this by next Friday, or I can't do this today, but I can, you know, giving your own timeline. So I guess to speak to that with boundaries, I know we already talked about how it's not always just no, like what is a boundary and how do you start identifying those needs to inform what the boundary would look like?
Yeah, for sure. So I like to think of boundaries as a verbal or a behavioral statement that we make to others to help us feel safe, comfortable, protected in relationships. Boundaries really help us honor our own needs, really by separating our own feelings and decisions and ability to ask for what we need without impulsively needing to please others. So it's really a protective mechanism for being able to walk in authenticity and show up for how we want to healthily navigate life. And that is so difficult because, again, this isn't oftentimes a thing that we are taught, a skill that we are taught. And so when people come into adulthood and they say, I don't even know what boundaries are. Like, what is that, right? What's really important is recognizing that you do have boundaries. You might not know how to enforce them or how to really clarify them, but we all have boundaries, right? Like the sort of norms that you have of how you operate your house, those are boundaries, right? How we operate with our families. And so what's important is to start really analyzing and thinking about, do the way that I navigate relationships, does that feel good for me? Or am I avoiding relationships? Am I dreading the phone calls? Am I, you know, just hoping that topics don't get brought up at Thanksgiving dinner? Those are red flags that your boundaries need to be adjusted.
And for people who really do struggle with this, and maybe they don't even know what boundaries are or that they need to set boundaries, like, obviously therapy is a huge, is it would be recommended to like work with a therapist or a coach to kind of work through these things. What else would you recommend, or would you really say that that's kind of the route? And what does that even look like tangibly speaking, for someone who's maybe never been to therapy or worked with a professional? What does that experience look like, and what kind of can they expect in terms of working through that and starting to work on those boundaries?
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up, Mia. I think that this is sort of the challenge for me around social media, is I have such a heart for just wanting mental health care to be accessible, but there's only so much that can be shared over a platform before we really often do need someone to sit down and sort of help us navigate and build the skills necessary for us to heal. So I really appreciate that you're pointing that out. One of the first things that I do with clients when they come in to see me is to start with identifying values. So oftentimes people have an understanding of what they think their values are based on what they've been taught by their family, oftentimes caregivers, right? The thing about values is they change so much throughout our life, given whatever it is that we're going through, the season that we're in. And we need to be clear with ourselves on what we value so that we can be protective of those areas. And oftentimes when we sit down and do some deconstruction of our values, we find that people want to over-identify with things that they want to value, but they often aren't things that they actually value. So once you can be clear about that, you can really start to look at the aspects of your life that you haven't been honoring and that you really need to start establishing boundaries in so that you can be protective of your core and really come back to being able to celebrate yourself.
I love that. And that's kind of one of the goals that I have with this podcast and just with everything that I do, is helping people recognize that Instagram is an incredible platform. I think it's been amazing for educating people and helping them feel empowered and start to get more information and, you know, maybe start to take those steps in their own life. But I do think that, you know, it is limited, right, to some extent. And it's amazing that it makes it more accessible, because many people may not be able to afford or have access to a professional to work with. But then at the same time, you know, it can be that, like, I think a lot of us are getting this pseudo education, or we think we're learning something, or, oh, I know this now, but then we don't know what to do with it, or it's just kind of limited. So I think it's a challenge, because there is the accessibility component, but Yeah, it's just kind of knowing the power of something, but also its limitations and how we can give people still access to the tools that they need and giving them maybe a little nudge in the direction of where they even need to be going. So anyway, thank you for addressing that. And one thing I wanted to mention with values and ask you about is, how do you know the difference between, or not the difference, but understanding when to compromise? So for example, let's say, you know, you have this set of values, and I know in value, or for values, you're saying it's kind of like intrinsic to your core, but let's say you value something and then your partner values something and you're thinking about how you want to raise your kids, or you're just thinking about like a relationship with them. Where does compromise come in when it comes to boundaries? Because like, how do you know, like, no, this is a hard boundary, this is something I'm not going to, you know, even consider changing, versus, and with people pleasing, right? I think it can be hard to know, like, am I changing this because I want to please this person, or am I changing it because actually, now that I think about it, you know, maybe this isn't like a hard rule for me, or this isn't, you know, so, I don't know what the word is, but, you know, not malleable, I guess.
It's not non-negotiable.
Yeah. Right, non-negotiable, right. Yeah,
I think it's experimenting a little bit. No, that's not often the answer that people want to hear. They want me or others to like give them a definitive thing, like this is what you need to look for and then this is what it means. Often you have to experiment and you just have to practice awareness, I think. Awareness about how you feel, awareness about, you know, what you need, and to also really tune into, you know, how do I feel about making this decision, right? Is this important to me? Is that important to me? Where can we compromise? And it kind of cross-sections with the idea that sometimes boundaries are also choices. They're not necessarily just boundaries, but it's like, I have to make a decision here as to what do I want to stand for and what do I want to continue doing.
And that can, like, again, very much change, right? And so what you had a hard boundary on in your 20s may look very different when you have children or when you get married. And I love the concept of compromise because it is really important. And how do we get there? We get there by knowing ourselves and communicating what our non-negotiables are, and also having a partner, hopefully, who's done work around values as well, that can say, well, this is from my perspective why this is important, so that we don't take things so personally, but we can reattach them to their values and the way that they are seeing things from that lens.
Would you say it's then safe to say, like, I guess I want to say to people listening that, like, it's also okay to change your mind. It's okay to change, you know, over time. And I think there's this idea, especially with relationships, that I've always struggled with, or I think people maybe underestimate, which is that we do change over time. You know, we completely change. Hopefully you are evolving over time. And like you said, something that was important to you in your 20s or when you were younger, or that you thought was important to you. I thought that was really insightful as well, where, you know, with our values, something we say, this is so important to me, and then literally nothing that we're doing or nothing that we're saying aligns with what we think is so important to us, or what we've been taught should be important to us. So I guess I lost my own train of thought there, but I guess, like, yeah, it's okay to change your mind. And with a long-term relationship, how do you go about those conversations where maybe I said, you know, I would never do this, or I don't know, you've set a boundary essentially, and then you decided, actually, I want to kind of evolve that, or I want to adapt that or amend that. How do you go about those conversations, especially if it was maybe something where you aligned and your partner had the same, you know, value?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think first you gotta identify, like, is this an emotional response that I'm having, or is this truly how I'm feeling, right? So really having those conversations at a time where you're emotionally sober, you're experiencing emotional sobriety, is going to be super key. Because yikes, if we're having these, like, that's not my value anymore because I just had a terrible experience, right? Like, that's not authentic to what's really happening in your psyche. But you need to build trust in your relationship so that you can have that vulnerability and say, like, hey, I've been doing some reflecting and I'm realizing that I recognize, right, that I said that I might never feel this way, and I think I'm changing my mind, and can we kind of talk about that? I think it's important to have people in your circle who also know you, that sometimes you can bounce those ideas off of for conversation, right? That can be difficult with people pleasers because we don't want to be seeking those answers from others. But sometimes being in our own head can feel really overwhelming. And so having trust and authenticity in relationships can help you get to the place where you can have the freedom to say, you know what, I have evolved and I have changed my mind, and it's okay to do that. It's absolutely okay.
I think you've summed it up there perfectly. It's about, you know, is this a mood I'm in, or is this really something that I want to change? Is this coming from me, or is this coming from other people? Sometimes when we change roles, like when we have a baby, for example, we feel the pressure of society and of how things should be. And it's very easy to fall into these ideas of, oh, I never thought I wanted a house, you know, and then all of a sudden you want a house. It's like, is this coming from society? Is this coming from my parents? Is this coming because I'm scared and I just want to, you know, hide away in societal expectations and not do things differently? And as you said, I think open and honest conversation is important, and it has to go both ways. Like, we have to allow our partner to do the same thing, and then to not see the change as like, oh, I'm changing, this is me, even though it is that, but to see it as something separate. Like, oh, this is what's happening, can we talk about that? So it's less about, like, it's not like me against my old self, it's like me against this. It's like, let's figure this out together.
Yeah, 100%. Okay, I would love to talk to you both all day, but I know that that's not possible. So I want to wrap up with just two more questions. One being, Clara, I know earlier you mentioned like that you don't love the concept of faking it, right? And faking it till you make it, or to ever do anything that's really inauthentic to who you are. But I'm wondering about, as we start practicing saying no, setting boundaries, is there ever any value in setting a boundary just to kind of practice setting boundaries, even if, you know, like, let's say a friend asks you to do something and you're like, I need to practice saying no. So you say no, even though you actually wouldn't mind, or you don't even know if you would mind. But is there any value in that, or should it really always be intentional? I guess I'm just wondering, like, for the very beginning, recovering people pleasers, how can you just start taking some action in setting those boundaries?
I don't think so. I think it should come from an authentic place. But I also don't like the idea of like always and never, right? Mm. So what works for you might not work for me. So you really have to try things that work for you. And I wouldn't practice, you know, saying no just as a practice with maybe friends, but maybe it might be a good idea with strangers in a cafe. You know, if they're like, hey, do you want to round up? And you're like, no, you know, just trying to do it there. And then also, I think it's very underestimated practice to say no to yourself, to certain things. Mm-hmm. Like, no, I'm not going to turn on Netflix right now. I'm going to go read the book that I'm really interested in. I'm going to go on a walk. I'm going to call my friend. So boundaries, especially for people pleasers, can be very scary because we're so non-confrontational. Like, we don't want to say no to another person. It's a great way to start saying no is to just practice with yourself. No, I said I'm going to go to sleep at 10:30. I'm not going to you know, start doing laundry or watch a movie.
So that's binge this new show.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's actually what I recommend people to do, to start out with themselves, because oftentimes people are like, where do I start? I literally have boundary issues everywhere. And it's exactly that. Start with yourself. You don't have to have difficult conversations with your mom that you've known for 40 years, but you do have to look at your life and think about, okay, I told myself I was turning off my laptop at 5 p.m. Am I going to honor my needs and choose that right now? Or am I going to violate my boundary? If you can't start there, then you're going to have a really difficult time setting those difficult boundaries with folks in your life that you have been sort of leaving really porous all of your life.
Yeah. And you can do it in relationships too, where you set boundaries with yourself. So like the example with your mom, if your mom keeps calling you with problems and you seem to always be her problem solver, maybe this time you're not going to make any suggestions. You're just going to listen. So you have the boundary with yourself. I'm not going to get into this. Doesn't mean you're going to tell your mom, I'm never going to give you advice moving forward. You just go, and you're a little bit more passive about it.
I love that. I think starting with yourself is a great, great place to begin. And that's how you can also start to identify what your needs really are, or how it feels when you did turn off the TV and do something that you said you wanted to do. And when you actually follow through on those things that we say we want, or, you know, that we do want, but we don't make time for, or we don't allow ourselves to experience. So I guess lastly, I do want to ask, though, when you do start setting those boundaries in your relationships and you're not getting a positive response, either, I know, you know, maybe a family member is like, I don't like this, or like, why are you suddenly so harsh, or, you know, whatever it is there. That's not because you're being harsh. It's not because you're doing anything wrong, but they're just not used to it. Or maybe they have their own struggles with boundaries, or in your relationship, you know, like as you start to develop this more empowered sense of self, others may not receive it well. So one, do you have to be prepared that maybe you will lose some relationships and, you know, that is something to be prepared for? Or how do you address that when it's really not, you know, the people on the receiving end just aren't handling it well?
Well, what I really want to start out with is I think this is a huge fear that everybody has of like worst case scenario. That's a huge reason that people don't want to initiate boundaries because they think, again, they make that story in their head, right? The reality is many, many times people will respond to your boundaries well. And so if that is something that you're struggling with, I encourage you to really try to recognize when you're putting your expectation on the outcome of setting a boundary, right? But for those situations that people do respond to your boundaries in maybe a more negative way, that's very realistic, right? Especially for those long-term relationships where you've been doing things a certain way your entire life. People are allowed to disagree with your boundaries, right? You can set a boundary and they might say, I disagree with that and I'm not okay with that. You have to choose whether or not you are going to maintain that boundary and, again, honor your own needs or bail on them and rescue someone else's feelings, right? And similar to what Clara has been saying, I think it really depends on the relationship, right? If it is someone who is continuing to violate my boundaries, I might be approaching that very different than someone who I care a lot about and I have a long-standing relationship with, and I might see that as an opportunity to open up conversation and say, you know, I'm going to choose to be vulnerable with you and share why I'm choosing to do things differently, right? That might be due to my mental health. That might be due to what's going on in my circumstances. But what's important is remembering that you have the choice to share a little bit of information about your boundary setting or a lot of information, right? And sometimes the best things that we can do is start really small and not feel like we have to over explain why we're doing things.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually always recommend my clients that when they're experiencing someone who is very difficult, who they already know, like in a very enmeshed family, that they're going to get pushback for their boundary, don't give up too much information because they're going to use that to try to manipulate you to take up back your boundary. And that doesn't mean that they're malicious people, right? But this is how they've learned to deal with, you know, stress and everything. They've put you in your role. And if you deviate from that, that's going to create stress.
What do you mean by that? Sorry, in terms of not offering too much information or not over explaining, or that they use it against you?
Yeah, boundaries can sound very different depending on, you know, how you set them. As a very short and firm statement, you could say, no, unfortunately, that doesn't work for me. Right? That would be something I would use with someone who I know might give me a little bit of pushback here and there. And I'm just not willing to get into it because I know where it's going to go down to. And this is not something I'm negotiating. Or if it's a friend where I feel safe, I could say, hey, I'm really trying to make better choices for myself. And it's actually really hard for me to tell you no, because I really want to help you. But I know in my gut that I have to say no and do this other thing instead. Sorry about that. Those are two very different statements, and one or the other goes well depending on who you said it with, right? How they receive it and what their ultimate intention is.
Sometimes people, what they'll want to do when they start setting boundaries is say like, I know that I never used to do this and like, it's really hard for me, but like, I just really can't make it to that event. And I know you're going to be really mad at me, but also like, I really hope you're understanding where I'm coming from because this is really important to me. And do you get it? And then it's like, I don't even believe you, you know, because you have overshared so much that it doesn't feel like sort of authentic. Like, I don't believe that you even know what you want in that statement. And so that often happens to folks, especially around family, when family wants to be like, well, why was last Thanksgiving different? Or you've never brought that up before. You don't have to explain why it's different this time. And I think that that is the permission that Clara is talking about, that like, we don't have to give other people that explanation if we don't want to. That's our choice.
Got it. Yes. And I think being able to assess that and maybe identify where it is safe to give more context, or where it is just, this is what I've decided, this is, you know, this is what I'm saying, and letting it kind of sitting with the discomfort around that and just letting it be. Maybe we just need to figure out, yeah, and maybe back to also experimenting a little bit, like figuring out where it feels right to give more of an explanation or more context, and where it just feels like, you know, this is what it is, and this is where we're going from here. So anyway, thank you both so much. This has been an amazing conversation. I'm extremely excited to publish this episode. Can you both just tell people where to find you, how they can work with you, and mostly how they can work with you and where they can find you?
Sure. You can find all of my information on Instagram at The Boundary Therapist.
You can find me on Instagram. My Instagram name is fitting right in.
Awesome. I absolutely love both of your Instagrams and the content you put out. And Lacey, you found like the perfect handle. So...
Well, I'm just a baby in the Instagram world, which I'm okay with, but don't judge how many followers I have if that's what you're into. So,
no, it's the content, and I think the content is fantastic.
That's all I care about. I just want people to get the help that they need, you know?
Yeah, that's what I learned a long time ago. It's like, it's not about the vanity metrics. If you believe that something you're sharing is valuable to someone, then it's worth sharing, and, you know, hopefully it resonates, and if it doesn't, you know, hopefully the next piece of content will. And there was some purpose in you creating it. So anyway, thank you both so much. And we'll talk again soon. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. You can find information about Clara and Lacey in the show notes. Also, just so you know, we have the domain askingformyself.com. And I also put everything there. Like, everything's on the website, resources, all the products that we've mentioned throughout the show's history, bios about the guests, all of the things. So if you ever need a resource, you can go there. You can also go to talktaboo.com. There's a lot more content on the website about all of these topics. There are other resources. We're also building something new to help connect you directly with a therapist or therapist resources. And a lot is going on. So anyway, feel free to check any of that out. I also wanted to say that I think one of the reasons that it's difficult for me sometimes to, you know, prioritize the podcast, other than not having 20,000 hours in a day or Beyonce's team or anyone's team, frankly, I don't have a team, is that sometimes it's, you know, I feel a little bit disconnected from you, the listener. And I just feel like I'm talking into the void. And even though I see listens and downloads and, you know, people engaging on Instagram, I think that I don't know who you are. And I want to know more about our audience and who's listening and kind of what questions you have and what would be helpful for you and to you and who you want on the podcast and what kinds of questions you want answered. I think that'd be amazing. So whenever I get questions or DMs, it really helps me feel more connected and really gives me more direction. So feel free to DM me. You can DM me on my personal, but you might as well just DM on the Asking for Myself Instagram page. So hope to connect with you there, and looking forward to the next episode. I will get it out ASAP. I really will. And thank you. Hope you enjoyed. Talk to you soon. Bye.